Welcome to Why Don't We Dress for Dinner Anymore with senior style icon Teddy Krockman
and Melissa Pierce, documentarian and natural redhead.
For now.
Today we have a wonderful guest on, Monica Corcoran Harrell.
Hi, Monica.
Hello. Monica
is a journalist, screenwriter, and founder of Pretty Ripe, a multimedia platform for women proudly over 40. Women's Wear Daily calls her the midlife midwife, nice. And she's been quoted as a thought leader in Time, in Style magazine. She programs and leads provocative panel discussions for clients like South by Southwest, Soho House, and Neiman Marcus. Monica also writes about beauty, fashion, wellness, and culture for the New York Times, New York Magazine, and The Hollywood Reporter, and has created branded content for Morgan Stanley, Estee Lauder, and Lionsgate. Her first feature film about two middle-aged women who unwittingly swap bodies with Gen Z influencers is up at Netflix. And she's currently developing her viral essay, My Mom Has No Friends, into a sitcom for 20th Television with Mandy Moore. Monica lives in Los Angeles with her family. She loves being an older woman. Welcome to the podcast, Monica.
Thank you. This older woman is so happy to be here.
And I'm trying to look for this older woman because I don't see one in front of me. So that being said, Monica, I just want to let our audience know that one of the reasons that I became aware of you was through a really funny essay that you wrote about your mom called My Mom Has No Friends Anymore. And as I said in the introduction, you're developing that into a sitcom now that may be shown on one of the national networks. So congratulations on that. We're really looking forward to it. Your mom in that essay sounded like such a fun person to know. And you're talking about looking for friends for her and her enjoyment in a cocktail or two. It was just, it's really charming. And I was just wondering, does the apple fall far from the tree? Would you describe yourself as having the same type of joie de vivre as your mom does? Or would you say that you're a totally different type of personality? And then just bringing it back to our little bit of fashion sense over here, would you say that you have the same kind of sense of style that your mom does, or is yours completely different?
My mom is a character. She's fun. She's charming. She's unpredictable. It's funny you asked that about our similarities. I will say, and I talk about this in the essay, what I really learned from my mom growing up was how important it was to have girlfriends.
Yeah.
She's been in a very happy marriage. So her friends really were her support system. It was a community where she could be herself. I think my dad somewhat suppressed some of her more zany characteristics. So that was her safe place. And I thankfully am not in an unhappy marriage, but I do find that I really thrive around my friends. Mm-hmm. You know, it's where I try out new ideas or, you know, talk about things that maybe feel like they could be taboo. It's where I really like let my hair down and have fun. So I learned that from her. But because she grew up in Brooklyn, she's a slightly different sensibility than I do. She's probably a little harder edged. She might be a tiny bit louder. Mm-hmm. But I feel like as I get older, I'm coming into my own much the way my mom is. And I don't know if you two feel like this. I'm louder. I move through the world with more ease. Obviously, I'm less concerned with how other people react to me. So I think I'm becoming more like her with every year that goes by.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because I noticed that in myself too, that sometimes even when I laugh, I sound like my mom.
Yes.
Laughed. Even my laugh, even my husband says it, you know, sometimes I'll be upstairs watching something funny and he goes, I think it's your mother upstairs. The way you laugh. So I even laugh like her. It's funny because You know, when we're younger, especially when we're teenagers, we try to separate from our mothers. We don't want to be like our mothers. You know, we think we're just too cool for school and that kind of thing. But it's funny how much they really do influence us, and how much many of us, I shouldn't say all of us, but many of us do kind of turn out to be very similar to our moms. As far as loudness, Monica, I come from a Greek family. We always talk loud. That's the only way you get heard, is to like basically scream. So, you know, loudness is not anything that came with my mom. I mean, we were all loud. You know, it's funny. I have a cousin who was a school teacher. And when she was teaching class, a lot of the other teachers would get mad because they'd have their classroom doors open. And my cousin Kathy would be teaching her class and they'd all be slamming their doors. Oh, and no. They'd tell her afterwards, "You're talking too loud.
Oh, no.
And they can't hear my lecture because you're so darn loud." So it was just kind of like a family.
I come from loud people too.
Yeah.
But, and you asked about my mom's fashion sense. It's funny. I remember, so I was born in 1967, so probably really came into my own when it came to style in the 80s. But in the 70s, I remember borrowing her clothes. And then in the 80s, I really gravitated toward the pieces that had a 70s vibe, whether it was cool with like a high boot or like a Norma Kamali jumpsuit or a DKNY or a Donna Karan, I should say. Not Donna Karan, Diane von Furstenberg, wrap dress. Yeah. So I always liked those type of clothes.
So you're like a 70s gal.
Absolutely.
Right? Me too.
Boho. Right. Is that your favorite? Is that your favorite fashion era?
It is. And one of the things I love about your show is that you really talk about the psychology of style. Mm-hmm. And when I look back, why do I love the 70s so much? I love the film. I love French New Wave film. I love like The Godfather and Dog Day Afternoon, a lot of the movies that came out in the 70s. But also, you know, women were starting to fight for their rights. So culturally, there was a lot happening. And, you know, we weren't wearing as many undergarments. And I'm all for Spanx, don't get me wrong. But like, it was a celebration of a woman's kind of slinky silhouette. And I really appreciate that. And I like that bohemian style too. So,
yeah. 70s was an interesting era because it started the early 70s. Because don't forget, gals, I was in my like quote unquote prime in the early 70s. I graduated high school in 1971. So the early 70s was a lot of what we call boho chic now, which really stemmed from the hippie movement, really wearing kind of vintage looking clothes and blue jeans and things like that. But as the 70s progressed, as you mentioned, Monica, Diane von Furstenberg came out with the wrap dress, which is still a classic today. I mean, I have wrap dresses that are 30 years old hanging in my closet and I can still wear them. So we kind of moved from the boho look to the mid 70s. I remember it kind of becoming a little bit more sophisticated looking. And then we popped right into the disco era with the Studio 54 and the glitz and the glam. And then you saw the glitz and the glam move into the 80s as well too. So it was kind of, I always think of the 70s as kind of a renaissance era because it really encompassed like almost three different kinds of style. We had Halston, who had the beautiful chiffons and silks that were swirling all over. And then you had the other end of the spectrum with the kind of the chokers and the peasant blouses, which I love all of it.
Yes.
Right. Wait, you have to tell us about your necklace. I've been admiring it quietly.
I know.
This is turquoise, and it's by a local designer named Devon, D-E-V-O-N, Lee, L-E-I-G-H. And I get so many compliments on this necklace.
I lent it to a few women
because it's one of a kind. But I recently reached out to Devon and said, I think you should make more of these.
Yeah.
Composite turquoise.
It's fantastic.
And it came out, is it like attached to that chain?
It is, and it's actually not a choker. It falls about here.
Oh, you pulled it down.
I only wear it down here when I have a turtleneck on. I'm very, very cognizant of where my necklaces fall, but I love a choker. So I pull it up and I put a rubber band in the back to hold it in place here.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
That's a good trick.
I use those mini hair clips.
Oh.
You also use for orchids for the same thing.
Yes. Yes, I have those too.
Oh, yeah. For the orchid branches.
For the orchid branches, I use it for the back of my necklaces to adjust them. Well, gorgeous. I recall going to some sacred pools in Taos and having to drop little pieces of turquoise in as a prayer before getting in them. And you're just wearing this prayer on your neck. And it's just absolutely fantastic.
Thank you so much. I like that thought. I will remember that I'm wearing a prayer around my neck. We all need prayers.
We do.
Yeah, especially now. Well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you, Monica, is you had an essay in your Pretty Ripe where you talk about how stress can make your hair go fucking gray.
Not just regular gray. Fucking gray.
And then you gave some great tips on how to relieve stress, etc. But let me just ask you this, being a gray-haired lady myself, what's wrong with gray hair?
Dang. You snap. You're absolutely right. And I am completely accountable. However, as much as positive as I am about aging, I think anti-aging thinking and rhetoric is very systemic. We're all conditioned in that way. And, you know, for me, I dye my hair. However, using that quote unquote fucking adjective was a miss. I'm going to own up to that because a lot of my readers ask me how to stave off gray, how to stave off their, you know, salon appointments. I find that thinning hair is probably a bigger concern than color, but I think you're absolutely right. I was remiss and I'm going to go back and I'm going to take that out for people who go and read that piece.
Well, that's great to hear that you acknowledge that was a miss because, and you know, I'm not meaning to be confrontational. I was just actually really curious about what your response would be. But, you know, especially at my age, it's discouraging sometimes when you hear younger women who are very concerned about aging to the point where, you know, they're shooting up their face with Botox at 40. At 40, I didn't have a line on my face. What are you Botoxing? And I'll hear, it's preventative. I don't know what you're preventing because the minute the Botox goes away, the wrinkle will still appear. It's not going to prevent anything. But I just think that there's this concern with younger women and even women my age, because most women my age still dye their hair. You know, I'm few and far between who don't dye their hair. But I think there's this big concern with women who have gray hair, yet we never question why men have gray hair. You would never say to a man, well, why don't you dye your hair? You'd look a lot younger. We don't even question that. But with women, even my hairdresser the other day, she says to me, now, you know, in my own cynical way, I'm thinking, well, she just wants to sell. She wants me to come in every few weeks and do the hair dye because it costs a lot of money. But she'll say, yeah, I don't know. You know, you look so much younger, you know, and she says, you know, the only thing about gray hair is that people automatically assume that you're older. And I looked at her and I said, Tracy, I'm 71 years old. I am older.
Yeah.
I am older. And she knows how old I am, you know, but it's like, when do we stop trying to be 21?
I have to say, I have to be contrarian. I love fucking gray. right? Because there is this thing where, one, my hair is red. That's my identity. That's who I am. I am attached to it. It's me, right? So when I think about my hair changing, that's my whole identity changing.
But your hair has changed.
I mean, my hair, yes.
Underneath that hair dye.
My hair has changed, right? It now grows in like strawberry blonde, and it's too light for me and I dislike it. And so I put a gloss on it every couple of weeks, just myself, mm-hmm. Which is why it probably looks like a carrot right now. But
your hair is gorgeous.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
You're both so good looking. You should move to LA.
We
need more good looking people in LA.
But fucking gray is also this like, my identity is going to change whether I want it to or not.
Right,
and I would rather let it be a little bit more slow. I would rather slow it down. I'm not ready to change who I perceive myself to be.
Right. And I don't understand
it. That's not as much of a youth thing. It's like Samson, my hair is my identity. It's my strength. And if I'm changing that, who even am I when I look in the mirror? So like our visual selves are so powerful.
Let me ask both of you this question then. Because I totally understand it. I dyed my hair all the way until I was age 66, you know, so I'm not pretending like I'm any great crusader here. And truly, yeah, I wasn't ready to go gray in my 40s or my 50s, whatever. But the question I would ask you both.
Go for it.
I totally forgot. I'll be honest with you. I got to pick. Don't tell me it's a senior moment. I'll slap your face.
It's a wisdom moment.
Okay. This is the question I would ask both of you. Do you think men identify with their hair as much as women do?
Absolutely.
You think they do?
Absolutely. My partner started balding and he totally went on a journey. Who even am I if I don't have this massive curls?
Uh-huh.
And now, you know, he shaves his head. He got super buff. Uh-huh. He needed to identify outside of.
But he was able to transition pretty quickly, it sounds like.
A few years, a couple crises. The transition was tough. He didn't get a motorcycle. He got some electric bikes, though. Considered buying a bike, you know. So I do think men go through it.
How about you, Monica? What do you think? Do you think men
I agree with Melissa. However, I do think men go through it on a more superficial level. And by that, I don't mean superficial as in fake, as in less deeply than we do. Because we in part identify with our hair because that's how other people identify us. And my husband is Israeli and he has gorgeous, dark, you know, black hair, full head of hair. I don't know how he would react, but let me just tell you something. This man never washes his face. He doesn't put anything in his hair. So I can't imagine that he's as attached to this hair as a talisman as I am to mine.
Right.
I think men, we discount that men don't go through the aging process and have their own mourning over, you know, what the physical, I don't like to say the decline, the physical transition. Let's put it that way.
It's a transition.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for us to realize that really, I think you put it well, Monica, is that it is a transition. It's, you know, a lot of women look at it as the loss of their youth, as the loss of their beauty. But I think there's a different kind of beauty in maturing. But mm-hmm. just like anything else, if you don't take care of yourself, sure. if you don't maintain yourself, if you don't eat healthy, if you smoke, you drink a lot, you sit in the sun, you're not going to transition into that mature identity as well as if somebody who's actually taking care of themselves, you know, physically and mentally.
And emotionally, for sure.
Yeah. So yeah. I think that's a very important part of transitioning well into being a mature woman, because everybody is aging. An infant born today is aging. Everybody is aging. It's just you notice it more. when you hit a certain age, because, you know, you're losing some elasticity in your skin, you know, a few little wrinkles here and there are showing up. But who's to say that wrinkled, sagging skin can't look nice too? Well, it's just a different way of looking. It's not, you know, you could get a facelift and have your face pulled back so tight you look like you got your face stuck in a bus door. It's not going to make you look like you're 20 or 30. I don't care what. You're never going to look, when you hit a certain age, no matter how many things you shoot into your face or how many plastic surgeries you get, you are not going to look young and you are not going to look middle-aged. You're going to look like a mature woman who's had some face work done.
Right. You know, I do want to point out the morning, and I hear you. I do want to point out the morning, you know, Brené Brown did this research, Men, Women, and Shame, and she found that men's shame was in performance. Like, if they don't perform well, they have deep shame. Women's shame, even now, is still based on the way they look. Mm-hmm. So there is a deep shame in this transition. So there is this mourning of trying to undo that, as at least as I transition, trying to undo the shame of like not being the most beautiful, whatever, whatever, as I was in my 20s. There's a lot of shame attached to that still in our culture. So that mourning is real. As you let go of that, you have to work through the trauma of that. Of being judged, of feeling deep shame about your looks.
Right.
Which is wild.
Well, you know, I don't think you're men like, ever.
No.
Very, very thoughtful and poignant and a great launching point for more discussion. I don't think men ever apologize for their looks, whether they look unkempt from oversleeping or they're hungover or they just haven't gotten dressed up. And we as women not only apologize, but if we get a compliment, we deflect it, which is too bad. But I want to get back to what you were saying, Teddy, about transitions. I think as human beings, we should be taught that life is a series of transitions.
Yes.
You know, whether it's from your 30s to your 40s, whether it's from one job to the next, whether it's your perspective. I think, unfortunately, we're somewhat taught that like things that stay the same are good. You know what I mean? There's stability.
Exactly.
Really very little stability in life. I mean, I witnessed that with the fires here in LA.
Yes.
You are constantly transitioning and being tested. And I think if you anticipate life as a series of transitions, you're less disappointed when they happen. You embrace them and pivot accordingly.
Yeah.
Would you say your mom sounds like a very kind of lively, like I said, social person. Would you say that she has influenced your perspective on aging at all?
Absolutely. I cannot wait to become my mom. she just has the best life right now. I mean, she's fortunate in that she's retired and not working. She's 83. She stays up watching like shows on Netflix. She likes sci-fi and she likes kind of like mystery, thriller, crime stuff, not true crime. She goes out with her friends. She listens to classical music. She dances in her apartment. I know she gets lonely sometimes.
Yeah.
She fights a lot with her cat. They don't get along. shocking. But I also see that she's curious. Beyond that, she's very curious. She talks to everyone. And I just see that like nothing has been snuffed out. If anything, her candle really does burn brighter now,
there
because she's confident and she's like, you know what have I got to lose? I may as well just be myself,
right,
like a kid.
Has that helped you in your, like you have started Pretty Ripe. This is a great platform and you've seen your mom thriving. Has that helped you being this, I don't know, midwife of midlife? Like how has that played into that? And can you talk about Pretty Ripe a little bit?
Sure.
And why starting at 40?
Well, I started Pretty Ripe, I think about 5 years ago. And I will tell you, I was writing for women's magazines for much of my career. And when I hit around like 48, 49, 50, I started pitching ideas about perimenopause and career pivots. and this, you know, myth of the invisible woman. And, you know, I reached out to my editors at Elle and Marie Claire, even Huffington Post, and everyone said, you know what? Our readers sort of tap out after 40, according to our advertisers. So they didn't want to write articles for women who were 44 or 48 or 52. And I was so put off by that. I was like, this is such a sensitive time for so many women. How could you abandon them after that? You know, after they've been with you and they're in their 30s, their 20s and their 30s. So I just started this newsletter and wrote about weightlifting and how important that was as you got older and the symptoms of perimenopause and a great foundation by Ilia that I loved, a serum that I felt like was really wonderful for my age because I looked in the mirror one morning and I thought, what happened to my glow? I used to glow. And my skin had changed, you know, estrogen depletion, all of the biological effects of getting older. And it just grew from that. And I will say I made it after 40 because that's what I heard from the magazines.
Why does 40 seem to be the magic age where we consider women to start becoming invisible?
Which is crazy because that's when you're you have the spending power. Why aren't advertisers?
Yes.
What do they think?
I will say that's changing now. Yeah. I think magazines have really woken up and embraced Gen X and beyond. I think in part it has to do with, you know, biologically, women stopped having kids at 40. I had my daughter at 42, and let me tell you, I had to like call in the IVF National Guard to get pregnant. That's just my story. But I think for most women, if you start trying to get pregnant at 40, you're a little behind.
So
I would make that correlation. I think there's so much of how we behave is still pretty primal in that way. It's biologically hardwired into us.
Do you think it's biologically hardwired, or do you think it's really stems from, you know, I love to watch a lot of old movies. And one of the things I remember reading about movie stars in the 30s and the 40s were that once a woman hit 40 in Hollywood, she was basically considered done and done. You know, there weren't roles, there weren't the good roles, or maybe there were a few character roles for the women that played the moms or the grandmoms all the time kind of thing, but they weren't going to be the star of the show, you know? So I'm wondering, is it really something that's hardwired into our brains because women aren't fertile and they're not giving birth in their 40s? Or is it because we just grew up with that trope of, you know, the old Hollywood, you're pretty much done when you're 40 and nobody's going to care about you. And that just kind of moved on. And the reason I'm asking this question is because I remember when I was in my 40s, I actually felt like I was coming into my own then. You know, I mean, I felt I looked physically the best I ever looked. I was mentally the sharpest I've ever been. My career was moving up. I just looked and felt great. People thought I was always thought I was 10 years younger than I was. And I'm thinking to myself, I looked hot when I was in my 40s. Why would anybody say, you know, oh, I'm 40, everything's going to start to fall? You know, it really doesn't. Women look great in their 40s if they take care of themselves, just like, you know, there are 20-year-olds who don't look so great because they don't take care of themselves. It's all in how you take care of yourself. But 40 is really not mature as far as maturing looking. So that's why I was wondering why you picked the age of 40 for your pretty ripe 40 and up.
Right. Advertisers plus.
So for you, what you're saying, Monica, it was what you were being told, that women who are 40 just weren't interested in that kind of stuff.
I mean, I really did think about inching it up to 45 or even 50, you know, but I had a lot of readers that were in their early 40s.
Yes.
And, you know, perimenopause happens, I think the average is like 44 or 45 when you start to feel the symptoms. But I know a lot of women go into it, particularly women of color, in like at 42, they just go through it earlier. And that is one of the reasons many women sought out the newsletter.
Okay.
On top of that, I mean, it was also just writing about the lifestyle of being older, you know, finding makeup that worked better, or just changing your attitude, finding purpose in life. But you were asking about 40 and whether or not this is primal. It's so interesting to me because I'm sure it's nature and nurture. But I was just interviewing a renowned psychiatrist, Dr. Lemke, who's out of Stanford. We were talking about dopamine. She wrote a bestseller called Dopamine Nation. And it's really about how we're constantly looking for rewards, right? We our brain wants to be rewarded. That is what we're hardwired to seek out. And she said, in part, it's because way back when we had to go out and hunt, that was the reward. We had to go out and find water. We had to find shelter. Those were the rewards. Now those needs are taken care of for the most part. So now we look for our reward hits through technology, food, you know, abundance. We have this overabundance. Wow. So I bring that up because I would not have thought that our behavior tracks all the way back to so early in time, like the beginning of civilization and why these things. So I think even though we evolve, a lot of survival instincts are still at play, even unconsciously.
Right. So you're saying these dopamine hits, these games on my phone, this is because I'm not hunting anymore. Like, oh, one more berry. Ting.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, that's so many berries.
And that's her theory. And I agree with her. I can see it. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Like we used to go for those hits just to survive. Now we, you know, stave off boredom or, I don't know, self-reflection by finding something else to do.
Yeah. Well, I love your newsletter. I love all the little tidbits you give. I even bought, you're going to laugh, I even bought that little Kate Moss t-shirt.
I love that. I get so many.
I love Kate Moss. In fact, I have a big coffee table book of Kate Moss pictures. So when I saw the Kate Moss little tee, I bought it and I love it. It's so cute. You know, so you give a lot of.
I'm glad to hear that.
Huh?
I'm so glad to hear that.
Oh, yeah. I
Kate Moss will be really happy to hear that when she listens too.
Yeah, I would have worn it today. In fact, I was planning on wearing it today, but it is so darn cold in Chicago. I literally have my heat up to 90 and it's still not warm in this house.
I think the feels like outside is nine. Maybe it's a little less. It's ridiculous. LA is on fire and we are freezing to death.
We are freezing to death.
So well, maybe not to death is hyperbole.
This damp kitchen with that little t-shirt on, I would have been like, oh, so, but I would have worn it for you.
Right. And the makeup tips for women in their 40s, totally true. I had to change everything about makeup and I was so unprepared for it. My teenage daughter is like, no, let me do your makeup. And I was like, that's going to look terrible now. I don't know what to do. So the makeup is real for anyone listening in your 30s. Get ready, bitches. It's real.
Game.
Yeah.
We call it pre-gaming.
Yeah.
I remember I interviewed a makeup artist and she said to me, you know, the misnomer is we think we need to cover up more as we get older.
Oh, and less. Yeah.
Less. Just a little concealer, like where you want your face to look brightest, under your eyes, you know, but not even use less makeup than you did when you were younger, which was like counterintuitive to me because when I look at my skin, I see things. Right. But then when I wear less makeup, I definitely get more compliments on my skin.
Yeah.
Well, you have good skin. I can see that. You've obviously taken good care of yourself there, kiddo. So, yeah.
I do. I've been writing about beauty for, you know, 25 years now. Yeah. So I've tried a lot. I mean, I've done my share of beauty treatments. I try a lot of products and I always try them for 2 weeks before I write about them so that I'm sure they work.
Well, I don't know if you're aware, but I have a Instagram site as well too. And I get a lot of stuff.
Oh, I bet.
And I always tell them, you know what? I'll be glad to try your product, but I have to try it for at least a couple of weeks to see if it, there's any difference. And if there isn't, I'm not going to recommend it to my viewers because I'm not going to lie. And so if it doesn't do anything or change anything, or I don't feel it, you know, makes my makeup go on smoother or whatever it's supposed to do, I'm not going to recommend it. So I always put that as a caveat because you're right. There's so much stuff out there. It's fun to play with it and try it and that kind of thing. It's rare that you find something that actually really is much different from the other thing. So when you do find something that's special, then that's something that I, you know, would want to tell people about because you don't want people spending money on crap that's, you know, not going to help them at all. But more in the vein of our fashion focus, do you have a favorite fashion uniform? Do you have kind of a go-to everyday kind of look, or are you, you know, I want to change my look every day kind of a thing? Where are you at in your own personal fashion style?
I wear sometimes the same outfit 3 times in a week, even going to events. So I very much believe in a uniform. I happen to have this shirt by a local designer, Natalie Martin. This is a shirt, but I have it in a dress. Oh. When I love something, I stock up on it. So I have 5 of these. So I do wear this when I'm feeling more like flowy and bohemian and feminine. And then there's a sweater by Claire Vivier, another LA designer that I have had to find on eBay and the Real Real to get 5 different versions of it. So when I find something that I love, I tend to just wear it because my barometer is, do I feel great? Do I feel like I could get the job done in this look? That is really what I ask myself when I look in the mirror. But in terms of personal style, I probably jump around. I don't wear as much tailored stuff. I think I wear more slinky 70s inspired, even my sportswear. You know, I'd wear slacks with like a long sweater. I think about Faye Dunaway. I think about some of my favorite film icons when I get dressed. I really do. Diana Ross. Yeah. Loved her style. I mean, she's great style.
Did Diana Ross change her outfit like for every song though?
Yeah. But if you watch like Mahogany, that is one of my favorites. I like to film for my style cues. Always have. Yeah. I can remember like Jenna Rollins in some of her movies, what she wore, some of her John Cassavetes movies.
Yeah, she was gorgeous. I saw a recent picture that she had made with her husband. I think it was called Faces or something like that.
Yes.
And she was just gorgeous. And yeah, the classic kind of dresses she would wear, the kind of, what do I want to call them? Like a shift dress kind of silhouette type of thing.
She wore a lot of Angaro, I found in film.
Yeah.
I seek these things out. And I love the silhouettes and the prints and the texture of the fabric. Yeah. So
well, it sounds like you have a lot of knowledge and love of fashion.
Right. And now I'm like, do you have 4 friends and they all are just like, we're all wearing what you're wearing. And because you've collected 5 of things, they're and you can go out. this was a terrible segue transition, by the way. I wanted to backtrack. You were talking about your mom and girlfriends and your girlfriends and friendships. How are you finding friendships now? Do you have a lot of younger friends? Do you have older friends? Are they across gamuts? You know, what's happening now as far as female friendships?
I put as much emphasis and priority on my friendships as I do my career, maybe even my family. I don't know if I want my 14-year-old daughter and my husband to hear that, but truthfully, friendship is so important to me. And I do find now, probably when I was in my 20s and 30s and maybe even my 40s, I tended to gravitate towards my peers. Now I have friends of all ages. I have friends who are in their 70s. I have friends who are in their 20s. It's all over the map for sure.
Why do you why do you think that is? Do you think you reach a certain point and then it's everywhere instead of right with that peer group? What do you think happens? Because I also have this happening.
You know, I was at a dinner party recently, all female. It was actually a beauty dinner, and we for a brand, and we were talking about that. And for me personally, I feel like I am so much more confident now than I have ever been in my life. So I really do look for the best qualities in people. I will ferret out what is interesting about you, what is compelling. I don't always find it in everyone, but because I'm coming from a base of confident and non-threatened and security, I can be open enough to look for that. So I think that's part of it. I also don't think I was never incredibly opportunistic about my friendships, but I think when you're in your 20s and your 30s, you know, you're moving forward in your career. And now, look, I'd like my career to go further, but I know that's on me and not necessarily the people I surround myself with, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes
sense. What about you?
Well, in the same vein, talking about friendship and what age group of women do you hang with, that kind of thing. I know that you're giving a 2-day retreat in March.
Yes.
And it's a women's retreat. It sounds like you're going to have lots of fun events and that kind of thing. What is it that you want your guests to come away with after this retreat? What is it that you're hoping that they'll have experienced or learned or come away with after spending a couple of days in this group?
So this will be the second one. The first one I did, I went hoping that women would feel inspired and empowered and be really open with each other. And I even had conversation prompts for the first night. So this retreat takes place at Alice Hall Ranch, which is right around Santa Barbara. It's a beautiful ranch. I mean, just stunning setting, and there's horseback riding, but it's sort of rustic luxury. But what I found, these women connected. They did not need me to facilitate. So I hope that in the immediate sense, these women would connect. And what they would get from each other and the workshops I created and even myself was to be inspired and walk away feeling empowered. And that was the case. And I will tell you, Teddy, it was billed as chapter 2. Second act at Alice Hall. I should know the name of my retreat, right? Act 2 at Alice Hall. And when I got there, a woman who just reached out to me to check on me about the fires, she's 72, named Karen Montgomery. And I thought it was going to be mostly women in their 40s and 50s. And we had all age groups. And there were no cliques. Everybody came together. And this woman, Karen, talked about how she climbed Mount Everest just to prove to her husband that she was fun, because he said she wasn't fun. And we all laughed, but we were so inspired by her. And these women had fantastic careers or not. And it just, the inspiration and the empowerment that we got from each other was really magical to me. It was pretty extraordinary.
So you're saying that pretty much from this gathering that the women kind of all supported each other, listened to each other, created new friendships, mm-hmm. Bonded in a way across age groups, which I think is fabulous because, you know, the things we see on TV, and I was talking to Melissa about this earlier, we do what we call a buddy podcast every now and then, where it's just she and I talking to each other on the podcast. And we were talking about reality shows and how they become like addictive and people call them guilty pleasures. And I was telling her how I watch The Housewives of Beverly Hills in New York, and I'm actually ashamed of it. You know, I'm actually ashamed because the shows really focus on nothing but these women stabbing each other in the back, bad mouthing each other, talking about each other, fighting constantly. It's not a good view of women. And for the most part, women I know might be doing that on a kind of a lower level, but it's not as in your face and mean and nasty as it is on that TV show. And so, you know, it's shameful that I even watch it because it's almost like it's like watching a bad car accident. You know, you don't want to look at it, but you can't look away kind of a thing. So it's nice to hear that you have something going that shows women supporting each other, being able to engage with each other across age groups, just like Melissa and I, you know, she's a Gen Xer, I'm a baby boomer, but here we are, you know,
doing our thing.
Right. So it's like, you know, we're all women. It doesn't matter what age we are. There's a commonality in our life experience as we go along.
Right.
And so it's good to know that you're doing something like that, that engenders that. Instead of TV shows that show women saying, oh, did you see, you know, really nasty and everything like that. And I'm watching that the other day and I'm thinking to myself, why am I giving them the ratings? And yet I'm sitting there like, you know, you know, and I'm like getting involved in their argument. And I'm thinking, I don't even know these people, you know, it's just, it's, we were talking about the dopamine hit that you get from these kinds of shows.
Right, that emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, it's an emotional roller coaster. And so you get involved in it, but you know it's not right. You know, it's not, you really don't want to perpetuate that, you know, stereotype of women who are constantly competing with each other and talking against each other and backstabbing. Because for the most part, I think women do want to support women, you know, and I think we have more in common that bonds us together, but we don't see that being reflected on TV as much.
Right. I mean, what it sounds like is you created this for, to help women with, even with their confidence, to feel more confidence in being empowered, to come into their power. And what happened was they were ready to come into community and they did so. And in that they made this netting, which made them all stronger and come into their power together, which sounds lovely. If it's not full, guys, you should get on that because that sounds incredible.
Yeah.
That really sounds incredible.
It sounds like a great.
I have to tell you, I left so inspired last year. And what I learned was these women, you know, I brought in thought leaders who spoke and we did workshops. But what I learned in the end was more time to let these women tell their stories because they all had great stories and they could really lift each other up. They didn't need thought leaders. We're all thought leaders, right? So that was interesting. So this time around, I'm going to allow for more time for just discussion in a group, because how often do you get to talk about, you know, your triumphs, your fears with women who don't know you, therefore maybe are not judging you. You're afraid to say this in your peer group or your friend group. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, it sounds great.
I'm going to get political for a minute, if you don't mind, because I was listening to what you were saying, Melissa, and I had this conversation with my husband this morning about, you know, where we're at as a society, gender-wise. And I really do think that men are feeling angry, pushed aside, and we as middle-aged women are coming together. And I don't think men have that, but at the same time, they also feel like victims of the Me Too movement. Don't get me wrong. I am sympathizing to a certain degree. A lot of that is valid, but I do feel like men are really threatened by women, especially women in middle age, because that is when we are no longer concerned with how they view us. We're more powerful, we're more confident. And I think that scares some men. I'm not going to say all men. I think that's why witches, usually women in middle age, were deemed witches, let's put it that way, so that they could be gotten rid of, right? And this is a really powerful time for women, middle age and beyond. Like, it is really our moment. This is our prime, if you want to apply it. And I think that's great for women. And I shouldn't put out this like caution about men, but I do think men see this strength and it's a little frightening to them and threatening.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Also, I also want to say, I think that they want that, you know, our society as a society has not given men the capability and confidence to have a community that is emotionally and mentally supportive. I mean, the closest they have is you know, sports ball. Like, we can have emotions about sports balls, but otherwise it's different. Which is why I'm always always encouraging my partner and my sons to go have bro moments where they talk about their emotions and support one another. Because it is very lonely if you've grown up in this culture. And then women being able to have that and also have everything else that men have traditionally been able to have is scary. Oh, they're taking everything away. No, we're just coming with more for what is our right anyway. And you could also have it. So a loneliness epidemic, yes, certainly. Some big backlash, yes, certainly. But it's emotions are scary. They're very scary for people who don't have a chance to feel them and are suddenly stuck with them in their 40s going, crap, I have the coping skills of a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And our emotions do motivate us. So
yeah.
What do you think, Teddy?
I think that that's very true of probably men. I would say 40, 45 up or something like that. I think younger men, I think they're learning to express their emotions a little bit more. I think they are not as threatened by women because they've grown up with women who are college educated, who are successful, that kind of thing. I think men like in my husband's age bracket, I can see that, you know, he actually joined the Masonic Lodge just so he could find some friends.
We're community.
You know, because all of his childhood friends have all been married. They all kind of retreat into their own families. And men don't carry out long-term friendships like women do. And so I think that's right. What you're saying is that they are in some ways envious of the relationships that they see their wives or their girlfriends having that they lack. But I would say that's mainly maybe what I'd say middle-aged men and up. And I'd say for younger men, I think they're going to be better off emotionally.
I hope so. I hope they hold on to their friends. I did read a study once that men who got married tended to let go of their friendships.
Yeah.
And just, you know, cleave to their wives.
Yeah.
And women didn't do the same thing. So men lost all of their friendships because they found this one person.
Yeah.
So they no longer had their friend group.
Right. And that's why you see, I think the other statistic is that a vast majority of men who are divorced or widowed will get married again within a year or two, where women will stay widowed or divorced, single for years.
Right.
Because they become so dependent on the wife to steer everything that's going on in the family, from vacations to shopping to holidays to everything else that tends to fall on our shoulders. And so then they therefore need somebody to kind of guide them. You know, I think what we did was we just raised our men to be big babies.
Right. I think I was like, oh, they're looking for that emotional safety.
Yeah.
And they don't have that in their community because they weren't allowed to build it. So they look for it in a partner.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of big babies.
I don't know. This is a totally different podcast than the one we were having, but I love it so much.
Well, and here's the thing. In our buddy episode that we just did this morning, one of the things that we're doing is broadening the topic of our discussion. Started out with the psychology of fashion and the history of fashion. But I think the title, Why Don't We Dress for Dinner Anymore, really is a metaphor for why have things changed? And have they changed for the better or have they changed for the worse? And so one of the things that we want to do on our podcast, and we're kind of doing that with you, Monica, is expanding the discussion beyond fashion to what are the other things that influence everything in our lives? Because ultimately, the way you dress reflects your life.
Right.
So there's a lot of things that affect our life.
Right. How do you want to be perceived?
Right. How do you want to be perceived? And what's your life situation?
Right. Thus the gray hair discussion. Like, what's that perception?
Right.
I'm not ready to let go of this version of me yet.
Right.
But you let that go I would like to think gracefully, but it sounds like you dyed your hair up until you
66.
Until you were like, you know what, this is the time.
Yeah.
Which is wild. I'm like, how do I do it? I don't know.
When I hear that title, I also think about the importance of rituals, because we get four rituals. And, you know, there was a time I grew up and I had dinner with my family every night. My mother never asked me what I wanted for dinner. I got what she served.
Right.
And I'm the same I just kind know. Of yeah. My mom was working part time. So it was slightly different in terms of her responsibilities outside the home. But, you know, we have dinner most nights here in my home. It's my daughter, my husband, and I. But there are nights that we don't, and I don't always blink. And then a few nights will go by where we're fragmented and doing different things, and I'll realize we need to come back and have dinner together. And I love the idea, why don't we get dressed for dinner, is, to me, speaks to these rituals that brought us together that are falling by the wayside.
Right.
Right. As we write new social contracts, all of our rituals change as well. And what are we holding on to?
Yeah. And just talking about why don't we dress for dinner anymore is, what are the social norms that have fallen to the wayside? You know, there was a time I remember my mom would say, oh, we're going out to eat, I've got to get dressed up. I mean, it wasn't a question of, you know, am I going to wear my jeans and my top or whatever? It was, you get dressed to go out. Going out to dinner is something special, you know, so social, as social norms change, the way we dress changes as well too. And it's reflected in the way that we dress. You know, if you look at movies from the 30s and 40s, you know, they show people now, of course, it's a glamorized version of life because the Depression was going on during that time, but you saw, you know, the glamour, the, you know, going out to a nightclub. There were nightclubs then where there was people dancing and eating and that kind of thing. Our ritual of eating has even changed. Like you said, Monica, even, you know, your nightly dinner with your family. My mother never asked me what I want to eat. This is your plate. Here's your food. Right. Eat it. You know, my grandson comes over and we, Alex, do you like macaroni and cheese? Alex, will you eat steak? Alex, will... And I'm like, why are we like adjusting to this kid?
Exactly.
Because he's like, you know, 9 feet tall already, and he's 14, and I'm worried about if he's going to eat his dinner. If he doesn't eat his dinner, too bad, then go hungry.
He's going to be okay.
What's the matter with me? You know, but I adjusted to the social shift, you know, where we're catering to everybody's particular tastes, as opposed to, this is our family meal. We're all going to sit down and we're all going to eat the same thing. If you don't like it, then fine, then don't eat it. But no, we're not going to make you a special hamburger because you won't eat, you know, steak. Or we're not going to make you a special spaghetti because you don't like this, you know.
I feel like this comes back to something you said, Monica, about abundance. And it is about how there is so much abundance around us. It is no longer miraculous. It is not a miraculous abundance. We are so used to it. We don't even see it, and we don't celebrate it, and we don't respect it. And that's from the top of my head, thinking about your Chinese exchange student who said, I dress to show you respect, or you dress to show me respect.
Right.
And this lack of
appreciation
for them. It's not even gratitude.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, you don't have to be grateful for every plastic flower. Yes. But this, like, understanding the miraculousness of abundance and what we actually are. Yeah. We're just in this, like, well, everything sucks. Therefore, we can wear yoga pants to Olive Garden or whatever casual dining is available because it's all there. And they ship in all of the same food from the same manufacturers, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And like, we're not seeing something that is happening in the miraculous, even if it's not something we really want.
Right.
You know, in that miraculous. Mm-hmm. I don't want 100 casual dining places. I just want one really nice one.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree.
My mom had a rule, no jeans at the museum when I was growing up. So when we went into Manhattan and went to the Met or MoMA, we were not allowed to wear jeans. And
I remember the first opera my husband and I attended, and we were probably in our late 20s, and you know, everybody was dressed to the nines and everything. Now you go to the opera and there's people, they got their backpacks, their blue jeans, they look like they're going to go out to have a picnic.
Right.
Opera used to be considered an event. You know, you went somewhere special and ate, then you listened to the beautiful music and watched the beautiful performance going on. And now it's just like people are going to the movies, you know, wear a pair of jeans and a shirt and I'm going to the opera. So there's nothing really that's considered, like you were saying.
Yeah, I think
there's nothing that really people really appreciate as being elevated or being the need for to be part of that celebration that you're
right,
watching.
Because it's become so everyday.
Yeah.
The everyday is no longer miraculous because there's so much of it.
Yeah.
There's just so much.
Well, Monica, you've stimulated so much conversation.
Does that mean I get to come back? Maybe.
Definitely. Yeah. You're going to come.
Anytime.
You can come back after your retreat and report to us about
it. I will.
A fabulous thing. But before we leave, I just want you to give a little shout out to your newsletter, Pretty Ripe, and tell our listeners how they can subscribe to it. And just give them a little commercial about
Absolutely.
That before we let you go.
So if you go to prettyripe.com, you will see a tab to click to subscribe to the newsletter, which used to come out every week, and now it's more biweekly. But when it does come out, I cover beauty, I cover culture, I cover wellness, and I cover style, of course, fashion mm-hmm. as well. So please join me. And we do community events and Pretty Ripe on Instagram. I do IG lives. I'll have to have you two on an IG live. And I've had everyone from Dr. Marie Claire Haver, who's the famous doctor out of Texas who talks about middle age and menopause, to Claire Vivier, who is a designer, to Paulina Porizkova. So I try to get all these inspiring women on the IG live. So please join me. And I'm always encouraging people to ask questions.
Yeah. It's a great newsletter. I love it. I look forward to reading it. You always have some really cute tongue-in-cheek little story that you tell. One was about you apologize to your girlfriend because you're always canceling.
Oh, yes.
With her and stuff like that. So she's got some really fun articles in there. Good makeup, beauty tips, fashion tips. It's really a good read. So I would highly recommend it. And thank you so much, Monica, for being
Monica.
A wonderful guest on our show. And hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah.
Yes, we'll stay in touch. Thank you. That was
Bye-bye.
A delightful hour.
Thank
okay.
you.
Hey, Taylor, question. Why don't we dress for dinner anymore?
I don't know, Melissa. Why don't we dress for dinner anymore?
You got me. Bye. That's
the Bye.